This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lita Mahuri, is the director of Once Were Warriors, a new film from New Zealand. It's broken box office records there, surpassing even Jurassic Park. The film is about family violence in a Maori housing project. The Maoris are Polynesians who settled New Zealand before the country was colonized by Europeans. The Maoris of Once Were Warriors have lost touch with their ethnic culture and live in an urban culture of poverty and violence. New York Times film critic Janet Maslin said Once Were Warriors is ferocious, social realism with a savage kick. The Village Voice described its depiction of family violence as hard to watch, but even more difficult to look away from. Once Were Warriors is director Lita Mahuri's first feature. He says the film is about the consequences of alienation, what happens when an indigenous people is colonized and when a rural culture is transplanted to an urban ghetto.
The film deals with a post-Second World War urban alienation of an essentially rural culture that has split away from its origins and its roots and now become completely disoriented and dysfunctional, awash in alcohol and social welfare dependency and children growing up not having any sense of identity, and that breeding the seeds of disaster, really.
And a lot of violence.
A lot of violence because no outlets for what are essentially what were once a very proud race of men, now reduced to lines of queues of unemployed, large, tough men with a lot of alcohol and a certain amount of disposable income to spend it on. It's not an uncommon story around the planet.
Now, I believe your father is Maori and your mother white.
Mm-hmm.
Did you grow up in or near to the kind of urban alienated culture that you describe in your film?
Yeah, very close to it, but not in it. My father was part of a kind of a new vanguard of young educated Maori who was sent from who were educated and sent to the cities to essentially look after other Maori coming into the cities, find them employment, sort out problems that they had. And the emerging suburbs in the 1960s, 50s and 60s, were large. They were never called ghettos. They were models of new suburbia. But of course, that was all working class. We lived on the periphery of that, but not in it. And we were, my upbringing was more of a kind of almost white middle class upbringing. We were in a kind of very, very white suburb. So I didn't experience it firsthand, but I saw a lot of it. My father's was in welfare, in specifically Maori welfare, which is a separate unit of the welfare division. And so he would spend all his time sorting out other people's domestic problems, essentially. So we used to see the kind of results of it, but we're never kind of attached to it.
Did he maintain connections to Maori traditions, and did
yeah,
he
very
pass
much
any
so.
Of that on to you?
Very much so, but no. The saddest thing is he never passed it on to us because it's an interesting thing. It's almost something I could never talk to him about because of this thing about him becoming kind of the new wave. The new wave in the 50s and 60s, it was seen to be assimilate with the predominant culture and retain what you have about your own culture. And the saddest thing was that at that point in the development of Maori culture, it was seen more advantageous to assimilate with the white culture of the day and kind of just become part of it rather than retain your own identity and travel as two cultures. That's all changed now. The 70s and the 80s brought around a huge resurgence of pride in being Maori and a celebration of the culture itself through language and other things.
So what was the culture, or what is the culture? I that's a really big question.
Yeah,
I know
is.
Most Americans are totally unfamiliar with Maori culture.
Maori, part of Polynesia, part of a huge Polynesian people that drift from anywhere from Hawaii to right down to New Zealand through all the archipelagos and islands of Tahiti and the Cook Islands. And they settled in New Zealand, or Aotearoa as it was called by Maori, somewhere around, vaguely around the year 1000, I guess. So they've been there for nearly 1,000 years and have developed a kind of very, very refined culture, both spiritual and otherwise. A very warlike culture, very tribal, a very, very strong sense of family, ancestry, where you come from, who you are. Very important to know these things. To be Maori is to know exactly who everybody is that came before you. You're supposed to be able to stand up and recite all that. It's a very unlike European culture. Very spiritual people, very humorous people, and very musical and very performance-oriented people, too.
In your movie, Once We're Warriors, there's a lot of scenes of violence, violence in bars between men. The couple in your film, the man beats his wife mercilessly. And I think those violence scenes are really well directed. Now, I know you've said that you admired directors Sam Peckinpah, Martin Scorsese, Sergio Leone. They've all directed films with violence in them. And I was wondering if their different approaches to violence affected the way you portrayed it on screen.
No, not really. Much as I admire those guys and the films they made because of their kind of hard-edged cinematic realism, I admire so many filmmakers from Kurosawa to Pontecorvo to everywhere, right across the board, even, you know, right up to today, you know, with, you know, it doesn't matter. There's so many people I admire. When you come to do something like violence in the cinema, you know, every project is different, and this one had a specific thing about it which said that you could not do violence as entertainment. It had to be, this was anti-violence, this was violence in the service of non-violence. So in doing that, I just kind of had to create something I hadn't seen before, which was essentially as brutally realistic a form of violence as anyone could take, without weaponry, without guns, knives, or anything. So what I came down to was trying to represent a form of what I call street fighting and barroom brawling that no one's really quite seen before, because they've become too accustomed to seeing either American or other international product where barroom brawls are reduced to the form of a farce, where people get hit with chairs and they break and people slug it out. And, you know, it's kind of almost a comedy of manners now. And I thought, you know, in order for this violence to be repellent, he really had to show it as it was, as I've seen it up close. And anyone that's ever seen it happen like this knows that it's accurate. It's ruthlessly fast. It's over within seconds. And someone's unconscious on the floor in a pool of blood. So it was just a matter of trying to find a new way to do that.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things I felt watching the film was impact. I mean, the sense of impact. When a blow connected, you felt the impact. You felt the pressure.
That's
right.
It pushes you around the theater. You know, we really tried to. I tried to get that effect so that you felt it in your solar plexus. You could feel this thing coming out of the screen at you, and it even did it to me when I watch it. Maybe not so much now, but for many times after I finished it, it would do that. You'd feel it very, very physically. It's a film that moves you about.
So tell me how you worked with the actors to get the violence that's fast and that has impact and that feels that's really uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah, well, what you have to do is, I mean, it's pretty simple. Everyone's read the script. We all know what's going on in there. We read these scenes. I just told all the actors, there's no way this is going to be anything other than as brutally as honest and as real as we can put it on film. In doing that, then we go into standard cinematic techniques of fight arranging. You know, you get a stunt coordinator, and I tell them what I want and how I want it done. Then we organize it with the actors. I didn't want any stunt doubles or anything like that. I wanted the actors to do it all themselves, and because I think audiences are a little sophisticated and they know when the wool's been pulled over their eyes. And the other trick, of course, is where you put the camera. And I decided to go for an approach that didn't contain a lot of cuts, so to speak. The more cuts you put in a fight sequence, I think people know subliminally when they watch it, they know that there's some trickery going on. The more you can let a scene of violence unfold in one shot or two shots, it seems more terrifyingly real somehow, especially when you see the actual actors in there doing it themselves. So the scene with, of course, where the husband beats his wife up has a terrifying reality to it, because it's very finely tuned and the actors are doing it themselves at speed in real time. No slow motion, no nonsense, and the camera is positioned like a kind of fly on the wall, you know, where you're right there amongst it.
So where did you see the kind of violence you wanted to pattern your film on?
I grew up, as a young man, that whole pub environment, the bar environment that those guys inhabit is very much my upbringing. That's very much, I knew all that because I lived in it for 10, 12 years or more. In New Zealand, we have the most appalling social drinking habits in the world. And I don't want to go into the depth of why that came about, but there's many reasons for it. And growing up as a young man, any kind of, you know, fraternity of young men, you eventually end up, you know, drinking alcohol and driving cars and laughing your head off and having, you know, a great time until something very bad happens, like you get beaten up or you smash a car and you suddenly have to reflect on life. So I did a lot of that kind of hard drinking, and I saw a lot of that violence around me. But I'm not that sort of guy. You know, I've never hit anyone in my life. I kind of tended to avoid it because I have a natural cowardly streak in me. So. But when you see it at close range, you know how awful it is, and I saw a lot of it.
Well, you know, in the movie, you'd learn which were the characters that were the most volatile, and that when they went off, they'd really go off.
Mm.
Did you see that in Friends of Yours, that you knew
sure.
there were certain characters who
oh, yeah. And you
go
could,
off?
And you knew, and you almost... See, this is the thing that happens, and I think men all over the world relate to this. That bar environment, you'll find from Glasgow to New Orleans... New Zealand is no exception to it. Groups of men, tough guys, or people who believe they're tough guys in bars, you know, drinking, a combination of alcohol and braggadocio inevitably leads to people like the Jake Hickeys of the world, people who are admired for their physical strength and their ability to deal out punishment to other people. So those people collect around them acolytes and other friends who are not so strong because they know the other guy will take care of trouble should it occur in their bar. So it's as old as time itself. It's primal. And it still goes on.
Now, Jake, who's the husband in the film, is he's a really interesting actor. I mean, I've never seen him before, but he has he's really solidly built, and he has these really wide arms, and it's all muscle.
It's all a trick, of course.
And there's something actually in his performance that reminded me of Marlon Brando.
Yep, Stanley Kowalski.
Stanley Kowalski, exactly.
Yeah, that's what I based him on.
Oh, okay. Mm. Because you know, I saw the restored version of Streetcar Named Desire recently, and the way Brando plays Stanley Kowalski is that he's really physical, he's always beating up his woman, but there's something underneath it, some sensitivity you see underneath.
That's right. And, some sexual
charisma too, that you at least understand the attraction. And it's the same way with Jake, the husband character.
It's exactly
in your
the same. I'm glad you spotted it. A lot of people don't, but it is exactly that, and that's where I was trying to take him, you know, that had he just played this violent, abusive husband, he would have been a one-dimensional character, and I really wanted the audience to know or understand something of his plight as well as what made him this kind of guy, what motivated him. And he had to be all those things, kind of electrifyingly sexy or sensual, dangerously violent, completely screwed up psychologically, all these things, you know, and I think he did an admirable job of it.
I have one last question for you. We talked about how you tried to show violence in a way that you hadn't seen it shown before. Mm. And it's really quite impressive. And I can see you, I can imagine you getting a lot of offers from Hollywood now for action films.
Mm.
For films that are much more just about, you know, like action and violence. And it's more for entertainment value than anything else. Would you take on a film like that?
I would. I'm actually sort of doing one at the moment, but it's not what I call an action film. It's kind of like a period thriller, more like a Chinatown than anything. Those are the films I like. I've already said, I've had all those offers, but I actually don't want to do Steven Seagal movies or Die Hard 6, 7, and 8 and all that stuff. I think there's no end of hungry young directors who want to get out there and show their stuff and how they can, you know, get on a Steadicam and run around and do all this extraordinary stuff. There's nothing wrong with that. I like it. I like watching it. It's kind of cathartic to me, but it's becoming very much a kind of, you know, a blah. It's all becoming very much the same. You know, how many pyrotechnics can you see? How many cars can you see explode? I mean, come on, please. You know, I really, you know, they're great. They're amusing. They're good value. But every now and again, one comes along like the original Die Hard or the original Lethal Weapon. These are great, you know, the original 48 Hours. You know, these are exceptionally good action movies which recreate the genre and keep it fresh and alive. Then there's 50 imitators that come along and follow it, and then people like me are asked to direct them. Well, sorry, folks, I don't want to do them. But I do want to do what I call, you know, sophisticated American genre pictures, much like one that I'm doing now, which are very, very dark, deal with, you know, they're full of actors for once, to start with, but they're about human frailty and conflict between human beings and people, you know, what happens when people are pushed to limits or stress levels where they break. the kind of Alan Pakulis, Sidney Lumet type of very dark, interesting stuff, but occasionally goes hand in glove with exceptionally good action sequences.
Lita Mahori, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Lita Mahori is the director of the new film Once Were Warriors, and in a moment, we'll meet the star of the film, Raina Owen. First, a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Raina Owen, is the star of the new film Once Were Warriors. She plays Beth, who lives with her husband and five children in a Maori housing project in New Zealand. Beth has been married for 18 years and seems to love her husband, although he's become an alcoholic and he brutally beats her. New York Times film critic Janet Maslin wrote this about Owen's depiction of Beth. She's not simply a victim. Ms. Owen, a fiery actress with the sad, sensual look of a Hard Knocks Jeanne Moreau, radiates a physical vitality that makes sense of this union. Actress Raina Owen grew up in Maori culture. Her father was Maori, her mother white.
My mother married my father's in the 50s when it was a no-no still for white people to marry Maori people, so she was disowned by her family. So therefore we knew nothing of the English side of my heritage, so I very much grew up on the Maori side. My father's from the place I come from, Kawiti, and of course I grew up very much around the extended family with my grandmother, who was like the matriarch, central figure in our family, and it was a huge family. She'd had 15 children, and of course in my own family there were 9 children. And I very much grew up around the marae, which is like the meeting place, which you see at during Grace's funeral in the film. We didn't grow up with the language, however. That was the one thing we did miss out on for the same reasons as Lee. It's a very, actually a good example of the language. I mean, my father was a native fluent speaker and a beautiful speaker of the language. But in their childhoods, in the 20s and the 30s, they were forced to go to school. And they were actually whipped for speaking their native tongue. This was the way they were forced to speak English. So therefore, they never passed the language on to our generation, which is why we're sort of known as the lost generation in a way.
Are there traditions that you have kept in your life?
Yeah, well, I grew up from, I suppose it was my first encounter of the entertainment business as soon as I could walk. I learned traditional Māori singing and dancing, and I very much grew up on what we call it kapahaka. And I continued with that throughout college, which is how I got into drama, into my first stage production at the age of 15 years old as Bloody Mary in South Pacific, and then Calamity Jane and Calamity Jane. And those breaks were as a result of me being in the Māori Culture Club. I also obviously grew up with...
Wait, what is kapahaka?
Kapahaka is the traditional Māori singing and dancing.
Ah.
You see a little glimpse of it in the male dance called the haka, which you see in the film, and you see our All Blacks doing before the beginning of a rugby match. The other things I suppose I grew up with, well, as I said earlier, I grew up very much around the marae. We'd have to go to a lot of the huis, what we call huis, which are like gatherings, whether they're for funerals or weddings or for conferences or meetings or what have you. And of course I grew up with all the food, like our traditional hangis and puha and pork bones and what have you. And I very much grew up around an extended family. Yeah, so my background was very rich in Māori tanga.
How did being Maori influence the kind of roles that you were offered once you started to act professionally?
Well, it didn't. In London, I could play anything. It wasn't an issue. I mean, I was just seen as an actress, which is obviously what I prefer. I only encountered that when I went back to New Zealand, where I would only get looked at for Maori roles. And so I'd go along and they'd say, oh, no, but you're too European looking. So I'd go along for a European part and it'd be like, well, you look slightly Maori. So I found that very frustrating and very small-minded and very limiting in a way. In fact, in England, I was better off because I could play anything. I wasn't seen as anything. I was just seen as an actress because I've got very pale skin.
What's the movie industry in New Zealand like now, and how many opportunities are there for actors?
Limited. I mean, it's why I predominantly do stage work. Camera opportunities are very rare. We make anything from 1 to 3 films per year in New Zealand, and you're obviously not going to always be right for the roles. Television, you know, anything from 2 TV series per year, some half-hour dramas. It's limited. Camera work is very limited. Obviously, it's a very small, it's lowly funded business. So, yeah, I tend to spend most of my time in the theatre.
What do your older relatives think of you being an actress?
Oh, they're obviously very proud, particularly obviously too, because Warriors has had a huge success and they're very happy for me, definitely. In fact, they're the main support of my life, really.
What are some of the more personal reactions you've gotten from filmgoers in New Zealand who've seen Once Were Warriors?
The responses I've had have all been incredibly positive, quite phenomenal. But the reactions, well, particularly a lot of letters and fan mail, have been more from your average Joe blogs, basically, not necessarily film buffs. People like women and young teenagers write to me and, you know, telling me that they were a Beth or they were a Grace or how the film had been very healing and very empowering for them. In general, I think for the Māori people in New Zealand, that's the effect it has had. It's really empowered our people tremendously. And, of course, the social impact of the film has been incredible. I mean, two weeks to a month after it was released in New Zealand, the helplines, the lifelines were inundated with callers. Women's refuge groups were overflowing, anger management group, Men Against Violence, with basically women and men, not just Māori, Pākehā white as well, going along and saying, I've got a warrior's problem. So the film has become quite a part of the nation's psyche, and it's given people license, or a keyword, if you'd like to say, to talking about what's actually happening in their own lives. So, you know, for an actress, I feel very spoilt, actually, for my sort of first lead in my first major feature film to have been such a success at the box office, and also to have changed people's lives is quite an achievement.
Raina Owen is the star of the new film Once Were Warriors. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.